Well, thank you. I think I'm most nervous about being a dad. So I'm here to talk about our crazy interesting case that we had this last year. So just to start out, the Utah Department of Health was called upon about July 2016 about an individual who didn't have any travel. He didn't have any sexual exposure to anyone who had traveled. The only exposure that he had was caring for his father, who recently passed away and postmortemly tested positive for Zika virus. So I'll start with the father, the index patient. He's a male in his 70s. He traveled to an area with active Zika virus transmission. He actually traveled with his wife. They returned on June 14th. Symptom onset was June 17th, and then he passed away on June 25th. When he presented to the emergency department, he presented with a febrile illness, and he actually presented to the ER multiple times. The second time he went to the ER, he had joint pain, diarrhea, thrombopenia, and at that time, serology tests indicated that he was IgG positive and IgM equivocal for dengue. So he was thought to have been diagnosed with dengue shock syndrome, and that's what was first on the death certificate. But afterwards, his specimens were forwarded on to a commercial lab, and they were tested for Zika virus, and they came up positive. And the viral load was actually 100,000 times higher than the average that we're normally seeing with Zika virus patients. This was the first Zika virus death in the continental United States. So, you know, this by itself was a big headliner. You know, the news loved it. And then we found out about his son, patient A, who cared for him. Like I said in the beginning, through investigation, he didn't have any travel, no sexual contact. He is a male in his 30s who had onset July 1st. So kind of fitting the time frame after the deceased father. He presented with conjunctivitis, fevers, myalgia, and a macupapular rash on his face. Symptoms resolved within a week. There are many articles out there. There's one from the New England Journal of Medicine, if anyone wants to dive deeper on the medical side. But he did, you know, the more we investigated, the more we interviewed him, his story changed. It morphed a little bit. At first, he said that he cared for his father and helped roll him over. But then, you know, that changed and you know, lots of different family contacts with similar contacts that he had. So it was really hard to see, you know, what was it. On July 8th, he was PCR positive at our Utah Public Health Laboratory with a urine specimen. And further specimens were forwarded on to the CDC, both serum and urine. IgM positive in serum and PRNT. And then PCR was positive. However, due to the low CT value, we could not sequence that. We were able to sequence the father's, but not the son's. So again, kind of hard. So how did, you know, what happened here? How did the transmission occur between the index patient and patient A? So these were the objectives of our investigation. First, to assess possible pathways, you know, anything, how that could be transferred from person to person. Second of all was to look at the hospital workers. You know, is this being transferred from hospital workers that were also caring for that patient? And then third of all was to see if, you know, we actually had the vector in Utah and we didn't even know about it. So our methods, the first thing we had to do is get all those family members together. This was a Hispanic family, and so luckily we did have some Spanish speakers on board to interview each family member and their kids, and this is a large family, so it took some time. We also did a healthcare worker assessment, and last, to investigate the possible mode of vector transmission, we looked at both the mosquito side to put traps around these areas, and then we also did a community survey. And I'll go into more depth in each of these. So first of all, there were 19 family contacts who were interviewed. Many of them, we collected many specimens on them. If they were symptomatic, we collected tears and saliva and anything they would be willing to give us, and tried to test that. We looked at travel history, exposure to mosquitoes, exposure to bodily fluids, especially with the index case and patient A, and different areas where they would have contact at different homes, at the funeral, and I'll go into more of these locations. So a family contact was defined as someone who either resided in the same home as the index case or who had direct contact with any of the bodily fluids. So this is a busy chart, so I'll describe it. So these greens are the two positive cases. Up top is our index case, and over here is our patient A. The red indicates that specimens were collected and were tested. The blue is they attended the funeral, and then the yellow is that they attended the viewing. During the funeral and the viewing, you know, again, there was a lot of contact with family members, a lot of kissing, a lot of touching, hugging, especially with the index case. And I will say that many of these other cases did not live in the state of Utah, so we appreciate all of our other state partners who helped us out with this investigation. So here's some of the locations. This is the index case up top. So when he came home from the location, he stayed at one of the son's homes, and that's what the green box is. And then his first visit to the ER is right here, and he was only kept overnight and was discharged the next day. So he went back to another children's home in Utah. And then this red box indicates when he was admitted into the hospital, and here is death. And right here is the viewing of the body and the funeral. Another hard thing is the index case was cremated, so we weren't able to collect any specimens afterwards. On the bottom is exposures that patient A would have. So the green arrows are exposures at one of the son's house, and the yellow arrows are exposures at the other son's house. And then here is all of the contact that they had in the hospital. Patient A, slept over in the hospital, sometimes in the same bed, and so lots of contact during that time. So to evaluate the healthcare workers, our objectives were first to identify Zika transmission between the healthcare workers, which healthcare workers were actually touching the index case, and determine the different types of transmission that could occur. A seroprevalence survey was conducted with a match cohort there at the hospital, and we also reviewed the infection control practices. A lot of this was done by the hospital themselves with CDC and Department of Health guidance. So they really wanted to find out themselves, what was going on. So our match cohort, we had exposed persons, which in the next slide I'll define how we defined an exposed person. So that was anyone who had contact with the index case or any bodily fluids, and then compared those to our control group, so those persons that had similar jobs and responsibilities but did not have any contact with bodily fluids. So the hospital, in order to identify if a person, kind of the risk level of these hospital care workers, this is what they looked at. They reviewed the index case's medical records to see which hospital workers, had contact with the index case. They compiled the list and notified the employees, the managers, and then trickled down from there that they would notify their workers. Those managers and employees received a questionnaire, and so we did get you know, people that traveled to areas, people who were pregnant, people who had similar symptoms. And those people who we recommended testing for were those who had high-risk contact, who were pregnant or trying to get pregnant, who were currently symptomatic. So hopefully I can walk this down and it's not too confusing. So they identified an N of 132 potentially exposed persons to the index case. Out of those 132, 98 were interviewed. 20 afterwards were noticed that they were not exposed. And 14 were just unable to reach. Out of the 98 that we interviewed, 80 had blood drawn. 12 did not meet that criteria that identified before. We had 3 no-shows and 3 that declined. Out of all of this, everyone was negative. So even persons that had traveled and even persons that had symptoms. And so with our control group, there were 113 controls. 111 were tested, and again, all were negative. And again, with people who had traveled and symptomatic and pregnant. So for the vector surveillance, so as I said, there were the 2 locations, the 2 neighborhoods, and then where the index case was at, the 2 children's homes, and then we went around the father's homes. We collected mosquitoes around those areas with a variety of traps, the CDC light traps, BG Sentinel, OVA traps, just trying to see what we had there in Utah. We collected a total of 698 specimens for Zika virus. Didn't find any Aedes aegypti or Albopictus. Most of them, like we would expect, were Culex pipiens and tarsalis. And when we tested those, we only found a couple of those pools that tested positive for West Nile. So no Zika virus was identified in Utah. That's awesome. Our last but not least objective was the community survey. So we drew a map, and on the next slide I'll show you an example of the map. We drew a 200-meter radius around the 2 locations where the index case was at. Try not to put the index, those homes, right in the center so everyone would know, to kind of offset them. But we knocked doors, and this was over a holiday weekend in Utah, and so we tried to do it earlier than later to try to catch as many people as we could. We asked them about mosquito activity, about symptoms. For those persons who were symptomatic, we collected specimens and tested those at our public health lab. So here's just a map of one of the locations. You know, there were many houses, and there was a trailer park on the edge of one of these neighborhoods. So, you know, I had never been to this trailer park, but it was interesting to see how many people, you know, we were interviewing. Dead of summer, it was an experience. Yeah, it was hot. So we visited a total of 235 households. About 37% of the residents completed a survey. So that's about 209 individuals that completed the surveys. Out of those 209, about 59% let us collect a specimen and test those at our public health lab. People in Utah they're so nice, and they'll just give up their blood so we can test it. So out of the 121 blood samples, all were negative. And this is a population that is largely Hispanic, lots of travel back and forth between, you know, those locations where they come from in Utah. Many of them, again, were symptomatic, but all were negative. So, you know, conclusions. I wish there was an awesome conclusion that we found how this transmission occurred, but I don't think we'll ever know. So no other Zika virus cases were identified. I think that's the biggest thing that we learned from this, that out of all of the people who we tested, we didn't find one other Zika virus case, even with people that were traveling and who were symptomatic. And thank goodness we didn't find the mosquito in Salt Lake. I'm sure it'll be on its way with global warming and everything, but that's another topic. Again, like I said, it's unclear how patient A was infected. We continue to recommend standard precautions with healthcare workers, just, you know, because of the unknown. And it's just good practice. And caregivers should always be aware that Zika virus, you know, may be spread through bodily fluids. So I'd like to acknowledge everyone, because there was a slew full of people that helped us out. So thank you. I know.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if anybody had any thoughts in regard to the index patients' general immune status. Just if you had any underlying immune problems or why there's such a huge viral load. Did anybody ever discover any comorbidities or opine about why that might have been?
Thanks for bringing that up. I forgot to mention. So a month earlier, he just finished chemotherapy due to prostate cancer. So, yeah, thank you. I forgot to mention that. Big detail.
Thank you. That was great, Don. So I don't have so much a question. It's just another comment. And this happened before the Utah case happened. But in Maryland, we had a situation where Zika confirmed woman gave birth, and the baby died shortly after birth, and it was just very sad. She hadn't prepared her family for what was coming, and all the family was gathered there for the birth, and this was horribly traumatic. In short, the baby died, and everybody was mourning and passed the baby around to say goodbye. And we had these huge infection control concerns because, you know, the last thing on anybody's mind was concern about transmission, and yet this baby was just passed around to an entire family member. We didn't go and do any subsequent testing or anything like this, but this infection control concern has lingered ever since. I followed this investigation very carefully to see what would happen and was reassured, but I do think this is still something that needs to be addressed. I think it's still a gap. It would be hard to intervene and get to the family and say, you must wear barrier precautions to say goodbye to the baby. But anyway, it's just a comment and something I think needs work on or more thought.
Yeah, thanks. And I think time will tell the more interesting cases that we're able to identify. So thank you. Anything else?
I had two sort of more mundane questions. I apologize. So when the index case was tested positive at a commercial lab, is that right?
And then initially,
did you guys ask for the sample, I assume, and that's how you know that the viral load was so high?
Correct. Yeah. And that was forwarded on to CDC to determine the viral load, and then it was also sequenced and published in that New England Journal of Medicine article. So.
Which I probably skimmed, but have since forgotten. And then my other question was for the case A, it looked like he was symptomatic about 6 or 7 days before a sample was actually drawn, and I was just kind of wondering, how did you find out that he was symptomatic, and why was there that delay, and all that kind of stuff?
So between specimen collection and when it was tested, or onset and specimen collection?
Onset and specimen collection, yeah.
Yeah, so that was really what triggered it, is we found, you know, his specimen coming back positive from the commercial lab. So after we investigated him, he really didn't have, the symptoms were starting to resolve. And so that's why it was really hard. We couldn't do any more because his, you know, his viral load in those specimens were very low. I wish we could have found it earlier, because hopefully we could have sequenced it and matched them up and been like, woohoo! But, yeah, by the time we found it, it was a little late. So I think that's just one of the struggles that we have with the commercial labs. So.
Hi. From Louisiana. I just have a few questions. So it's great all the healthcare workers were negative, but I was just curious, when you said symptoms, were you using just fever, or what was the algorithm for that?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that too. So the symptoms, I mean, we use the CDC guidance, so it was one of the top four, fever, rash, myalgia, conjunctivitis. So they at least had to have one of those top four symptoms to be designated as symptomatic.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
So being that you knew kind of about the exposure to his father, why did you make the decision to do a community survey?
I think just to rule out that the mosquito wasn't, you know, causing transmission. I think it was just our way of ruling it out, along with capturing mosquitoes around the home. Yeah, just trying to see if any of the neighbors had anything. So, yeah. Cool. Thank you.